You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com. Have you ever wondered what it's like inside a screenwriter's mind? In this podcast, we explore how successful screenwriters tackle structure, plot, character, dialogue, and the film business. Get ready to go down the rabbit hole of story as we pull the best interviews from the archives of the IFH Podcast Network. Let's travel inside the screenwriter's mind. This episode originally aired on the Indie Film Academy podcast.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. I'd like to welcome to the show K.M. Wilden. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I know we've been trying to get this scheduled for a while now.
Yeah.
So, but we're finally here, and we're here to talk about something that a lot of screenwriters and filmmakers have problems with, which is character arc. Mm-hmm. and plotting and just general stuff. And I loved your book, and it's one of the best-selling books in regards to this. And that's why I wanted to have you on. So thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's great to hear that you enjoyed the book.
Yes. Now, how did you get started writing in the first place?
Well, I like to say that stories were my language. My first memory actually is of myself up in a treehouse at a family reunion making up a story. Becoming a writer really wasn't something that I saw as a career path when I was young. I was very interested in horses, and I really thought that I was going to end up doing something with them. Mm-hmm. But there just, came this day, probably mid-teens, when I realized I'd rather stay inside and write than go outside and ride. Mm-hmm. So for me, really, I was always making up stories, and it was just a natural progression of deciding one day I'm going to write this down so I don't forget it. And then, falling in love with the art and the craft of writing and storytelling as well.
Now, why do you write in the first place? Is it just something that you just can't get away from?
I mean, that's a good question. It's something that I continue to ask myself, actually. And there's always different answers. I think that writing is, first and foremost, obviously, it's this wonderful source of self-expression. Mm-hmm. It's a way of exploring life, of trying to make sense and bring reason to, this grand adventure that we're all on. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I've always been very much attracted to epic stories, to the archetypalism of that, and being able to, take our prosaic lives and be able to see the deeper, archetypes and symbolism and transform that into the delicious drama.
Yeah, because basically life is basically a journey. It's a story. And mm-hmm. we are the archetypes. We are the protagonist of our own story. But what you do as a writer, what writers do in general, is just cut all the boring parts and structure it a little bit better. Would you agree?
I think, it's a common bit of advice that writers, you can't write until you've lived. Mm-hmm. And I think, particularly since a lot of writers are introverts, that's something that we struggle with. We have this tendency to want to do our living in the stories. But I definitely find, the older I get, I'm seeing more and more the wisdom of that that advice. And I think that we, you know, we learn our stories, but living teaches us how to write great stories. So it has to be this symbiotic circle of, you know, developing both kind of both the inner and the outer lives, if we're going to both, if we're going to live worthwhile lives, mm-hmm. and if we're going to write worthwhile stories.
Absolutely. I think as artists in general, you have to live a little before mm-hmm. you can really create, unless you're a prodigy, which there are yeah. few of those. there's few Mozarts in the world. Now, what is your writing routine?
So it changes from season to season. It kind of feels like just whatever feels right. Right now, what I do is I like to dedicate mornings to writing. Mm-hmm. So I am not a morning person. So when I say mornings, it's like 10 o'clock.
Got it.
So but
brunch.
Yeah. So
brunch,
I drag myself out of bed and, you know, eat breakfast, work out, take care of just basic email stuff just to make sure that, you know, the internet hasn't imploded on me or something. And then from I make coffee. That's always the most important part. Obviously. And then from about 10 to 12:30 is kind of my dedicated writing time. I like to start by rereading what I wrote the day before to just, you know, kind of to be able to correct what I've done, you know, to kind of keep the copy as clean as possible, but also just to get back into the flow and mm-hmm. the mindset of what I was doing the day before, and pick a good soundtrack and then just try to keep typing. I have definitely found that when I'm too concentrated on trying to make every word perfect, that I get so caught up in that I never move forward. So even though I'm a perfectionist and it's hard, I try really hard to get into that flow and just keep typing. That's kind of my mantra, just keep typing. And ironically, I find that actually I write much better, that there's actually less to correct. Mm-hmm. When I can get into that flow state and just keep writing rather than, getting sucked into the procrastination of rereading and tweaking every little sentence as I write it.
Procrastination is one of the devils of a writer's yes. existence, isn't it?
Yes.
Now, what are some of the biggest mistakes you see writers make when it comes to character and character development?
I think this is something that obviously this is something I think about a lot. It's been a focus of my own writing, my own journey as a writer, and also the things that I teach on my website and through my books. But something that I have really been thinking about a lot lately, particularly in response to a lot of the big name movies and books that mm-hmm. we're seeing right now, is I think that one of the biggest problems that we see is a lack of realization that character and plot are not separate. Mm-hmm. They are two sides of the same coin, and you cannot have one without the other and still end up with an excellent story. Something that I harp on a lot is cohesion and resonance. Mm-hmm. I think that the benchmark of great fiction is something that presents both. It's a story that is cohesive. It presents a whole that is all of a piece, and it has something to say, and that what it has to say is one unified thought.
Now,
but also,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
I was just going to continue and say that resonance is part of that, is again kind of the flip side of that, in that you can have a really cohesive story where the plot works great and the characters all seem to belong within that plot. But if it's not looking deeper into saying something that's beneath the surface, you really miss out on that resonance. So in joining cohesion and resonance, I find that pretty much begins and ends with joining character and plot.
Now, I'm assuming you're a moviegoer. You watch mm-hmm. movies. Okay. So I'm assuming you watch Marvel movies and you watch mm-hmm. like
yeah, big fan.
The big and the DC movies as well.
Not such a big fan.
Exactly. So I was going to ask you, what makes what Marvel's doing, whether people like it, who are listening, who like their movies or not, they're doing something right because it is resonating with an audience, and a large audience at that, and a worldwide audience at that. Whereas DC is not, and they arguably have more popular characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how did Black Panther destroy everything, including the biggest stars? You know, what happened there? So I don't know if you want to – I don't want to get into a Marvel DC battle here. But but just as on a story, character, plot standpoint, what is Marvel doing so well that DC just does not get, other than obviously the Chris Nolan Batmans?
I think that – fundamentally, I think that Marvel started out with a vision for what it was doing, and DC is kind of playing catch up.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Mm-hmm. At this point, they're trying to copy Marvel's success rather than creating their own vision for what they're doing. And I think that's fundamentally what's happened. Marvel, I mean, has certainly had many entries within the series that are not prime examples of great storytelling.
Absolutely.
But I think that overall, what they've done is created an atmosphere where there's leeway for those mistaken entries, because they've created an overall story where people are identifying and interested in the overall plot, and particularly what they've done with character. I think that they have done an excellent job, particularly with their primary, their cornerstone characters, of Captain America and Iron Man. Mm-hmm. And I think that what they've done is they've been willing to be really honest with these characters. I think the Captain America movies, the last two, Winter Soldier and Civil War, are a particularly good example of this, mm-hmm. in that they did things with the characters that were not what you usually see in these kind of movies. And I think that they did that from a place of honesty about who these people really are, rather than necessarily who audiences have been trained to expect their action heroes to be.
That's a really good point of view, actually, because, I mean, that's probably why the Nolan Batmans did so well, because mm-hmm. we knew Batman. I mean, we all know what Batman is, but what he did with him, he made it a completely – we just got a different take on the character and a different perspective, and he acted in a way that we weren't expecting. And I think you're right, the especially with Captain America and mm-hmm. with Iron Man, because arguably those are not top-end characters in the Marvel Universe. They are now. But in the, you know, they're not Spider-Man. They're not the X-Men. No,
and great acting aside, because I think they were both extremely well cast.
Oh, absolutely.
They're not characters that on the surface you look at them and you say, audiences are just going to love this person. You right. know, you've got a goody two shoes on one hand and somebody who's an absolute jerk right. on the other. And yet we love these characters. The honesty and the empathy mm-hmm. with which they've been portrayed is, I think, at the heart of why the series has been so successful in the long run.
And what do you think the success of Black Panther was?
Because unfortunately, I didn't get to see that in the theater, so
not yet. Okay.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I didn't make it.
How? Well, you have to go.
Well, my theater's closed down. I live in a little one theater town, and the theater's closed. So,
so now you're done. You have to.
I'm gonna have to wait for VOD, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, it is a phenomenal entry into the Marvel universe without question. But it did something right, because it actually outperformed the Avengers.
Yeah, the trailers looked fantastic, so I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I can't wait for Infinity War. That is, I can't even imagine what's going to happen. But we're geeking out, so let's move on. So, how do you write a positive or a negative character arc for a character?
So, I believe that the fundamental premise of story versus situation is that there is change involved. Something changes from the beginning to the end of the story. Mm-hmm. That something is usually the protagonist, although it can be the protagonist changing the world around him. But usually what we see is either a positive change arc, which has a happy ending, mm-hmm. or a negative change arc, which has generally a unhappy or sad ending.
So can you give me an example of two of those arcs from some fiction?
Positive change arc. One of my favorite examples from classic literature would be Jane Eyre by mm-hmm. Charlotte Bronte. Mm-hmm. And negative change, The Great Gatsby. The thing about negative change actually is there's more variations of the negative change than we see of the positive. Mm-hmm. So we have a disillusionment arc, which is something we see in The Great Gatsby, which is actually very similar to a positive arc, except that what the character learns is not necessarily a positive truth. Mm-hmm. And we have a fall arc, which is where a character basically starts at a bad place and ends up in an even worse place. Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights is a good example of this. Mm-hmm. The Star Wars prequels with Anakin Skywalker.
Oh, God. They're
horrible. It's an example of an arc like that.
It's an example of many things not to do. But yes, I understand. He definitely starts off and ends off worse. Absolutely.
Anyway, so, and then we also have a corruption arc, which is where a character starts off in a good place. It's this classic negative arc where a character starts off in a good place and ends in a bad place. Godfather.
Breaking Bad.
Great example.
Breaking Bad.
I haven't seen that either, but yeah, that would be my impression of what I've heard about it.
First of all, you need to stop this interview right now and go to Netflix and watch that show.
Black Panther, Breaking Bad, got it.
You've got to watch Breaking Bad, for God's sakes. So any tips on how to write a good positive or a good negative?
Yeah. Okay. So the key to any change arc is that you're looking at a swivel between a lie that the character believes and a truth that he's either going to find and be positively transformed by, or that he's going to reject and therefore be negatively impacted and changed by his inability to absorb this truth. So the character in a positive arc, the character is going to start out believing a lie. And this lie is on some level going to be a survival instinct. Something has motivated this in his past that has led him to believe that he needs this lie to survive, to be able to claim his self-worth, or, you know, just to survive in an environment that enables this lie. Mm-hmm. And then over the course of the story, you know, the conflict's going to enter his life and create situations where he's going to be forced to recognize that this lie is no longer viable. Slowly, it's going to become less and less effective for him, you know, forcing him into this place where he has to face this truth, which should be always a painful truth, because if it's not, why hasn't he absorbed it before? So it's very much a story about sacrificing the easy things that we hold on to that enable us and prevent us from growth. And reaching out for the powerful truths that may be difficult, but in the end are going to be very freeing and allow us to move on and deal with our conflicts in a way that is empowering. And then obviously negative arcs are basically the opposite of that, in right. that the character ends up with a worse lie in a worse place than he started out.
Is there an example in movies that you can think of, a character that has that lie? I'm rattling my brain to find one, but I mean, a perfect example just as a human being is like, oh, I can't talk in front of people, but yet that's the lie you tell yourself, mm-hmm. not to go on and become an author and have speaking engagements and so on and so forth, because that's the lie that's safe. It keeps you protected.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually did an interesting exercise a while back where I kind of used the positive arc format that I use and looked at my own life, mm-hmm. and the things that I had accomplished as a writer. And, you know, starting out from this place, these lies that we believe, you know, as that I believed as this shy, introverted little writer who didn't even like talking on the phone, mm-hmm. and you know, having to confront that and face that over, you know, I mean, there were challenges and difficulties and painful moments, but being able to look back and say, yeah, I experienced this positive change and this embrace of a truth, you know, an empowering truth of courage and freedom in a sense. And so it was very exciting to be able to actually look back and see a complete arc in my own life, because we're experiencing them over and over, mm-hmm. in our own lives in many different ways.
And in many different areas of our lives, without question. And I think that's one of the reasons we love stories as much as we do, because yeah. they're basically us.
Exactly. As far as a movie example, since we're talking about sure. Marvel, despite its many problems, I have to say I really like the first Thor movie, okay. because I think that it is a good example of this beautiful change arc, mm-hmm. that happens. You know, he's an extreme example because he starts out in this extreme place,
yes.
you know, of arrogance and complete disharmony with understanding, you know, the truths of the world around him and what people needed. And then this really lovely arc in which he ends from a place of realizing that, rather than, you know, forcing war on somebody, that he's going to go to this place of self-sacrifice. So right. I really like that as a very obvious example of a positive change arc.
Yeah, and Iron Man in Avengers, mm-hmm. he sacrifices himself, and that's something that he as a character does not do.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, what makes a good villain? Because that is one problem, if we're going to go back into the Marvel world, that Marvel's had a problem with. They have not had a lot of great villains. at least in my opinion, and most of the people who troll the internet.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And yeah. So what makes a good villain, in your opinion?
First of all, I think it's important to differentiate between the idea of a villain, which is a moral term, mm-hmm. and antagonist, which is not.
Okay.
Antagonists have no moral alignment within the story. They're simply someone who is opposed to the protagonist's plot goal. They're an obstacle that's getting in the protagonist's way, and presumably vice versa. The protagonist is getting in the antagonist's way. Mm-hmm. So you don't necessarily have to come at a story from this idea that, oh, the protagonist's a good guy, morally speaking, and the antagonist is a bad guy, morally speaking. Obviously, often we resort to that and like that archetype for many different reasons. But I think it's important to start from a realization that just because someone is an antagonist does not mean that he is morally incorrect. Mm-hmm. And I think that then frees us up to understand the role that an antagonist plays within a cohesive story form. And that is someone who is a foil for the protagonist. Not just on a plot level, but if you're going to gain that resonance that we talked about, it has to be something that also is a foil for the protagonist thematically, mm-hmm. within that character arc as well. And I think that's where we see the Marvel movies kind of going awry, mm-hmm. with their antagonists, in that very few of them are really good examples of antagonists who matter to the protagonist's journey. They're just kind of tacked on so we can have plot, the fight scenes.
They're plot points, if you will.
Plot devices. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, I always find that the villains that believe in another story, they wouldn't be the villain or they wouldn't be the mm-hmm. antagonist, because their point of view, it's just their point of view, whether they're doing it to an extreme or not. I always find those villains who have good intentions but are doing it in an extreme way, I always find to be, you know, good villains or good antagonists, because they don't mean bad. They're just trying to achieve a goal, but something happened to them in their life or their journey that caused them to be a little bit more extreme. From an outsider's point of view, from their point of view, they don't mm-hmm. find it to be extreme. That's as opposed to the twirling of the mustache guy on the railroad tracks, which a lot of times antagonists turn into.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that one of the most important exercises that a writer can do is trying to look at the world from their antagonist's point of view. You know, really get into this person's head and give them a viable argument thematically for why they're doing what they're doing, to the point that they should be able to be in a conversation with the protagonist, who's also stating his viewpoints, and be able to present such a convincing argument that they're this close to convincing not just the protagonist, but preferably the readers or the viewers as well. Mm-hmm. So that you're thinking, huh, he's got a point. And I think that is, it's the key to really dimensional fiction, because that's how life is.
Right.
And also the key to getting the reader or the viewer to really, you know, ask themselves the hard questions instead of just saying, oh yeah, I believe the protagonist, he's the good guy, of course he's right. But when you're able to create this kind of dimension and kind of play devil's advocate with mm-hmm. your antagonist, you have the opportunity to get people to ask really interesting questions about the world and about their own lives.
Right, exactly. And that's why I think Civil War I loved so mm-hmm. much, because mm-hmm. arguably Iron Man wasn't the bad guy, or the group wasn't the bad guys. There was that other guy who was, again, a weak villain who kind of like put them all together. But mm-hmm. but there was two point of views. And you were either either on Team Cap or Team Iron Man. And it was very, you know, I was a Team Cap guy. I completely agreed with him. I didn't agree with what Iron Man was trying to do. But it was just a very good example of point of view.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's like you say, the bad guy in that movie was entirely a plot device. And the reason the movie still worked, the reason it was interesting, was because we had this interesting dialogue between characters, both of whom we actually cared about. And so we could understand where they were both coming from without assigning moral alignment necessarily to either one.
Exactly. Now, what do you do if your character has no arc? You've written a story with a character with no arc. What do you do?
Okay, another important distinction, I think, that needs to be made at the beginning of that is that a lot of people think my character doesn't change, therefore there's no arc in this story. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's true, but sometimes it's not. Flat arcs are actually just as viable and sometimes even more powerful a story arc as our change arcs. Mm-hmm. And what happens in these stories is that there it's still a story of change. But what happens is that the character, the protagonist, starts out the story already in possession of the main thematic truth. Mm-hmm. So he's already got a handle on, you know, pretty much a handle on whatever's the central question of the story is. And then throughout the conflict, he is able to use that truth to transform the world around him. So it's a world that believes the lie. And the protagonist is able to transform that world and essentially, quote unquote, give them the truth. Again, Marvel example, Winter Soldier, the second Captain America movie is a good example of this.
And again, not everybody in the story, antagonist and protagonist, have to change.
No, I mean,
if you look at Shawshank Redemption, the warden is the warden at the end, as he was at the beginning. Same thing goes for the guards. They don't change at all. The only people who change are the other guys. And some of those characters don't change either. I mean, only Andy and Red really change.
Yeah, I think that's a question I get asked a lot is, do all my characters have to have character arcs? And the short answer is no, because you go absolutely bonkers when you try to give everybody an arc.
Can you give an example of a movie that or a story that everybody changes? Like,
Just the thought of it's exhausting.
It's a lot.
But I think, you know, and the one of the reasons it is exhausting is that optimally you want every single arc in that story to be thematically pertinent.
Right.
That it ties into that same central lie or truth in a related way. So you can't just throw, this guy has a lie and this guy has a different lie and throw it all into the same story and expect it to come out and work. You want to build, you know, these character archetypes into a cohesive story form where they're all commenting on different facets of that thematic truth. And sometimes the comment is, this is what happens when you don't change. This is what happens when you stay static. Mm-hmm. The warden in Shawshank is a great example of this. You know, I think we could look at that and say, well, that's not such a great thing when you're not open to accepting truths and allowing your life to be transformed.
And it really is a key point of character is that lie, is that that lie and getting to a truth at the end of it. Is that kind of like the arc, if you will? Like you've got that lie that you believe, so you've got to break through that lie to get to what the truth is of who you are as a person, as a character in this story.
Yeah, totally. This is how I like to look at story. To me, story is ultimately about theme. It is about the character's inner journey, and the plot, in order to be cohesive to that, the plot is basically a metaphor, an externalized metaphor for that inner journey in which you're dramatizing this internal conflict in an external way. And obviously they influence each other. The internal conflict is going to drive the external conflict, and the things that are happening in the external plot are going to force and catalyze the change that this character is, you know, struggling against in the beginning of the story, and then is, you know, slowly as the story continues coming to this place of realizing that, yeah, this is really hard, but I have to do this if I'm going to, you know, improve as a person and reach any place of inner freedom.
So basically like Luke Skywalker in Star Wars 4, Hope, The New Hope, he basically has the lie that he's just a farm boy and he needs to stay to help his aunt and uncle. But, you know, a movie or two later, he's a Jedi.
Yeah, I think that the original Star Wars trilogy is a great example of an arc over the course of a series. Mm-hmm. In that there's distinct pieces of Luke's journey in each story. You can distinctly see how he's changing. I mean, even just go look for screenshots from each of the three movies. And, you know, the way he looks, the expression on his face, the way he's dressed, the way he looks in each movie is an obvious progression of who he is.
Mm-hmm. Without question. And I think it's probably one of the classic examples of the hero's journey and the story structure and all that stuff.
Definitely.
What's your vibe on the hero's journey? Is it, I mean, I know I've spoken to a few people who've said like, look, the hero's journey is great and you can literally attach the hero's journey onto any story. But it's not necessarily the end all be all.
I would agree with that. I think that the hero's journey is totally viable.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Tremendously insightful and very useful, but I don't think that it is, I don't think it's necessarily as useful a structure for creating character arcs, you know, across genre and without formula as certain other systems. It's something that's definitely influenced my work, but it's not something that I follow religiously.
And what are, can you just name a couple of the other systems?
Well, the ones that have been particularly formative to me, I'm a novelist, but actually the ones that have been most formative for me have been screenwriting books. So I'm sure you're probably familiar with a lot of these. Sid Field's screenwriting is a huge one. John Truby's Anatomy of Story was one that I've gotten a lot out of.
John was just on the show a few episodes ago. He's amazing.
Yeah, he's great. I absolutely love his stuff. Robert McKee's Story. That's another one that I think is just fantastic. And Dramatica. I mean, that is a really heavy system to get into, but it offers a ton of really interesting insights into archetypal stories.
Dramatica, you mean the software?
It is a software, but they've got a book as well, which I definitely recommend.
Okay, great. Now, what are some keys to creating that unforgettable character?
I think that, you know, primarily you're starting from a place of the character arc, because this is telling you how the character informs the plot and how the plot informs the character. And within that, you're getting that dynamic sense of change, which I think that is foundational to unforgettable characters. But from there, I think that several things that you can think about to help you develop characters are, number one, you're looking for dichotomies. You're looking for things in your character that on the surface don't quite line up. Jason Bourne is one of my all-time favorite characters because I think he is a brilliant example of this. You know, here's this guy who's a killer, you know, a total, quote-unquote, mindless killer. And yet he is arguably one of the most decent people that you're ever going to find in a movie. Right. And I love that. I love that that decency juxtaposed, you know, against somebody who is a murderer. Basically.
But it's like, but it's not his fault that he's a murderer in the way that he's been put in the story.
Actually, that's going to be my second point in that I think that another key to dynamic characters is that it always has to be their fault. Whatever's happening to them, they should not be a victim. At some level, they have to be responsible for it. And I think that Jason Bourne is responsible for what's happened to him because he made the choice to let them turn him into that killer. So, and that's what haunts him. That's the guilt that haunts him through the entire series is, you know, I did this. I let them do this to me.
But even though in the beginning, in the first movie, he's a victim of his own decision.
That's the point. He's a victim of his own decision.
Which is
brilliant. So there's really a level of responsibility. You know, rather than just fobbing it off and saying, oh, well, somebody did this to me, poor me. But like, oh, my gosh, I did this to me. I have to, you know, face this. I have to deal with it. And that's like a catalyst for change.
And that's so much more interesting.
Exactly.
Than just a victim. Like, oh, they did this to me or they did that to me. And I'm just dealing with the world. It's no, it was your choice. And now you've got to deal with it. Now, when you're going about structuring a plot, how do you actually kind of put it down? Do you outline? Do you put down, a roadmap, like a roadmap to the end and fill things in between? How do you actually do plot structuring?
So my approach to plot structures is basically the classic three-act structure. I divide each of the acts into – well, I divide the book into eights basically and go from there. But what I do and what I think – I'm a big proponent of outlining. My book, Outlining Your Novel, was kind of how I got started in doing the whole writing instruction thing. So I'm a huge on outlining. And I think what I've seen from people, those who aren't into outlining and are having resistance to the idea, is that they're often coming into the idea of outlining and structuring through this notion that – they're just going to sit down and fill in the blanks on their structure and ta-da, I have an outline. And that's kind of soulless and it's boring. And then you have to, you know, somehow figure out how to apply this skeleton to this story that you're going to create. Mm-hmm. So my approach, and I think that this is a really important way to approach either outlining or structuring, and that is you have to get a holistic view of the story first. So I enter outlining through basically a very stream of conscious process where I like to write longhand in a notebook, and I just kind of dump out everything that I know or sense about this story. I look for plot holes and I'm asking questions to kind of fill those in until I start getting a more rounded view of the story. And when that happens, I then have a rounded enough view to kind of be able to begin saying, oh, okay, well, this is going to be my first plot point. Here's the moment of truth at the midpoint where the character is going to start his shift from being focused on the lie to being more focused on the truth. And I can just, you know, start pick instead of looking at the structure and saying, okay, well, I need a midpoint, so this can be my midpoint. Mm-hmm. I'm instead throwing the story onto the page and then kind of looking around and saying, oh, this is the midpoint. So I'm taking the story and fitting it into the structure rather than using the structure to try to engineer a story. And then obviously that will help me find, you know, the parts that are missing that I need to fill in the blanks. But I find that a much more holistic process than starting with the structure and, you know, trying to create a story that's perfectly structured rather than letting it find its own structure.
Got it. And that's a mistake I've made in the past, and many writers have made in the past, is they take that hero's journey model and then they just start slapping things in. It just kind of like you're jamming everything in there, and not letting everything breathe.
Yeah, and it's not as fun either. It's not as subconscious and holistic. So I just find it's not nearly as fun as doing it the other way.
Now, do you find that too many writers today are not taking enough risks with their work?
I think yes. I would say yes overall. I think that there's this sense that they want to take risks and that they're trying, but that they don't understand. It's kind of like I always say that the only rule in writing is follow all the rules unless you're brilliant and then break them. Mm-hmm. But you know, we have to, in order to do that, in order to reach that level of brilliance where we're able to take these risks that take us beyond the normal story conventions, we first have to start with that foundation in what those rules actually are, what story theory is, and why it matters. Because if we don't understand that, then we're not able to make educated decisions about where to vary from it or where to experiment with it. But at the same time, I definitely feel like, particularly in screenwriting, I would say that it's the save the cat syndrome, I call it.
Yes.
Where you have this great beat sheet and then but you're following it so religiously. And again, I think not too holistically. And as a result, you end up, you know, with something that really doesn't seem fresh or original. It's someplace we've all been there before, right. You know, probably dozens or even hundreds of times. So even though it may be well structured, it may be well written, it just doesn't feel fresh. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a big difference between following a beat sheet or imposing that beat sheet on a story idea and allowing a story to holistically find that structure, because it will find that structure, because that is what we as humans resonate with as, you know, a story arc that we can connect with.
Now, what are a few secrets to telling a good story in your opinion?
Well, I think everything we've talked about
pretty much
comes back to that. I think honesty is key.
Yeah.
I really believe that to tell a story that is worthwhile, that is more than just surface entertainment. And I think entertainment's great. I mean, stories they start and they end there. If they're not entertaining, then forget about it. But as a viewer and a reader, I want more. I want something that is going to tell me something about life, that is going to make me think about myself. I do not want to be preached at, but I want an honest experience of character that allows me to see the world from someone else's perspective. Right. And the only way that's possible is if the author is, first of all, being honest with themselves about their lives, is leading a life of self-discovery, and is trying to, you know, have their eyes wide open to what that means, and is then able to bring that honestly to the page.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Is not censoring themselves, you know, out of fear of being judged, right, or whatever. But learning how to bring that in an authentic way that informs the characters and the themes.
I think last year there was a great movie example of that was Logan, which mm-hmm. was such one of my favorite movies of the year. And I think should have been nominated by far, but it was a perfect, entertaining, yet mm-hmm. made you think kind of movie in a large way.
Yeah, I love what I call pulp movies, yeah. You know, the comic book stuff. I mean, on the surface, they're cheap entertainment, right? There's silly people in spandex running around.
Right.
But when they're done right, you know, when they look a little deeper, as Logan did, and are honest about the characters, I think that mix of entertainment and depth is just fantastic. I think it's one of the best things in storytelling.
And it's also, in all honesty, what we kind of strive for, because if you can tell a story that's honest and deep but doesn't have the kind of – it has all the steak but no sizzle.
Yeah.
If you know what I'm saying? And then Hollywood is basically all sizzle and no steak.
Yeah.
If you can combine the two.
Yeah.
That's when Wonder Woman, another – if we're going back to the kind of comic book movies, another one that had a deeper understanding of things. Black Panther, when you see it, you'll understand as well. Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Now, this is a question I have for – I'm going to ask for all of us writers out here. Any tips with dealing with writer's block?
I think that writer's block is something that it always has a cause. And I find that vastly encouraging, because if you can find the cause, if you can ask the right question, then you'll find the answer. Mm-hmm. In my experience, it comes down to two different kinds of blocks. One is a story block. And one is a personal block. Mm-hmm. If it's a story block, it's usually you're stuck. You know, something's not working in the story. Logically, it's just not making sense and you're not able to progress it. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely the easiest one, because you can sit down. I like to do work longhand in a notebook. And I just start asking myself questions. Mm-hmm. Why isn't this working? You know, what is the problem here? And just trying to follow that back to the beginning and, you know, find a solution. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, relatively easy, because you can work your way through it and find an answer without any problem. Personal blocks are a little harder. This is, you know, something mm-hmm. going on in your life.
The lie, the truth, right?
Yeah, exactly. You're too busy working on your own character arc.
Right.
But yeah, you're going through something difficult in your life. You're depressed. There's, you know, you've experienced the death of a loved one, something like that.
Got it.
Or something much less dramatic. I mean, health can definitely have an effect on that.
Sure.
And in those instances, again, I think it's really important to identify, you know, what the problem is, instead of, I think, saying, oh, I've got writer's block. That's not the answer. You know, that's not helping you. Mm-hmm. You have to go deeper and find, oh, this is why I'm totally unmotivated right now. And then you have to evaluate whether it's a legitimate excuse. You know, are you just being lazy because you're scared to deal with the page? Well, you know, then you have to deal with that. And I'd say get back to writing. But if it's something else, you know, if you're going through a legitimate difficulty in your life, mm-hmm. if health is a big issue, then I would say be kind to yourself. You know, there's a time and a place to crack the whip and get to writing. Mm-hmm. And there's a time and a place to step back and concentrate on yourself and your life and not subject yourself to, you know, the guilt that is associated with the idea of writer's block.
One of the great movies about writer's block that I've ever seen was Adaptation. Did you like that movie?
I haven't seen the whole thing, so I wouldn't say I'm completely able to comment on that.
Well, okay. All right.
Nothing to add to the list.
All right, add it to the list. But I mean, but Breaking Bad, seriously. I mean, stop it. Now, and can I ask you, why do you think stories are so important to our society in general today? Why does it mean so much in today's, you know, I can understand when back when there was nothing to do other than hunt and gather. But in today's world, why is story so important still?
I think the story is hardwired into who we are as humanity. Mm-hmm. I think it's something that we have craved at every juncture in history and will continue to crave. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, it is a expression of self-actualization. So, I think it is particularly pertinent in today's, you know, society. We live in a first world country where for most of us, survival isn't an issue. You know, we have easier lives than arguably anybody, any other generation in history. Mm-hmm. On a physical sense, our physical needs are completely met. And that gives us a lot of time and space to address the deeper needs of life, self-worth, self-purpose. You know, what does it all mean?
When the Greeks had slaves, basically, back in the mm-hmm. day, and they could just think, and they could just sit around thinking deep thoughts.
Yeah, exactly. and I'm not saying we're on par with the Greeks.
No, we're not, but by far.
I think it gives us time to need to find, you know, answers. And I think story is such a great venue for that because, number one, it's very non-threatening on a certain level. It's something we do for enjoyment. Mm-hmm. It's an easy way to connect with, you know, our fellow human beings. Mm-hmm. But it also, when it's done well, is something that, you know, gives us insight into who we are, you know, as individuals, as a people, into our history, into our future. And I think that those are big questions, and they're questions that we all want answers to. And story is one of the best ways that we find those answers, not just on an intellectual level, but on an emotional level as well.
Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests. Can you tell me what book had the biggest impact on your life or career?
That's interesting. I actually just wrote a post about that a couple months ago. I was reading a really great anthology called Light the Dark, mm-hmm. Which had asked many, many different excellent writers what was their formative influence, basically. Why did you become a writer? And I'm reading this book and you know, they all have these blithe answers, which they probably thought about for a long time before they wrote the post. But it was just like they immediately knew what their response was. And I'm going, I don't know, you know, what was my formative influence? So I got to thinking about that and kind of just thinking about the stories that I'm repeatedly drawn to, the stories that I'm interested in writing, which again are very much this epic archetypal approach to drama. And there was a book when I was probably, I'm going to say 8 or 9, that my dad had actually read to me. And, you know, looking back now, I see it. It was this completely crazy, pulpy, melodramatic romance that was written in the 1700s mm-hmm. about William Wallace. It was called The Scottish Chiefs. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting. I just pulled it off the shelf and I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to write about this book. And I flipped open to a passage that I remembered and was just shocked by this book that I just kind of randomly chosen as the book and this passage that I kind of randomly turned to. And within that passage, it was about the death of a brother in arms in the middle of battle. And it was like, this is my writing. This is everything that I write about. And so it was kind of just shocking and interesting to realize that whether that book had actually influenced everything that I'd written afterwards mm-hmm. or whether it was just an example of something that I continue to resonate with. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting to kind of look back on that bit of my childhood.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life? Or not the film business, obviously, in writing or in life?
Well, that is an interesting question. I'm going to say I think it's been the idea of being kind to myself. Mm-hmm. I think that it's something that we see in people in general, but particularly I think in writers, there's this self-flagellation, this mm-hmm. constant sense that we're not measuring up, that we're not, our writing isn't any good. You know what we're trying to say.
We all suck. Yeah.
And I think a realization that, number one, we're all in this together and we all fail that way. So, you know, it's really not a benchmark.
Right.
But also just realizing that it's a journey. You know, life is not so much about the destinations as it is about the journey.
Oh, yes.
And that's true in life as much as it is in the actual writing process.
Now, this is going to be probably the toughest question of all. Three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, number one has got to be The Great Escape. That's my all-time favorite
movie.
We rewatch it every year.
Great movie.
Gladiator.
Oh,
definitely.
Movie.
And I'm going to go Master and Commander for the third one.
Wow, Master and Commander. Now, that has not been on the list before on the show. So
yeah, I love that movie. Patrick O'Brien, who wrote the Aubrey Mattern books on which that is based, is an absolute genius as far as I'm concerned. And the movie is one of the best adaptations of a – not just of a book but of a series that I've ever seen.
Very cool. And then where can people find you online?
Okay. So my writing website is helpingwritersbecomeauthors.com.
Okay. And that's it.
That's it.
And of course, you have many books.
Facebook and Twitter and all that. But you can find all of that on the website.
And you have many books that you've written and all that stuff. And we'll put links to all of them on the show notes. Katie, thank you so much for doing this. It has been an absolute pleasure talking shop with you. It really was.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Screenwriter's Mind at screenwritersmind.com.